7.
Okay. Whack him with your stick. You have to tell him you don't believe
him. Anyway, I want to apologize because Alan said I was a bit harsh when I jumped up and said I didn't believe it, and I meant it. I didn't mean to. I was trying. I only have good intentions.
But you weren't harsh. You just weren't precise.
I wasn't precise. I was a bit skeptical. I was just a teensy bit skeptical. So maybe I should have rephrased it. But today I'm going to talk about this geophysical project that I've worked on with Bill Cumming over the last several years. It's a geothermal prospect in Glass Mountain. The Glass Mountain Known Geothermal Resource in Northern California. And so one of the things I've learned through this project and through working with Bill Cumming, maybe some of you know him, but for those of you who don't, he's a geophysicist. He's not a modeler or an inversion guy like us, although he uses those tools that we provide to interpret data in the context of getting at the what's happening in the geothermal reservoir. And do those models make sense? They want to look at temperatures and alteration, and they're looking to try to figure out where to drill a well for a geothermal resource. So, we as modelers and inverters, we write code and we'll run our data through that, and we get these lovely models, but a lot of times we don't really stop and think about what they mean and whether those models make any sense to the people who actually look at the rocks and the geochemistry and the well cuttings and the well logs, so oftentimes there's a bit of a disconnect, and this project, if it taught me one thing, it taught me to always be skeptical of the results we get, and to really look at those results and see if they really make any sense. Talk to the people who know about the rocks, and see if that makes sense. Sure. Go ahead. So this is the Glass Mountain geothermal field in Northern California. It's about 50 kilometers to the northeast of Mount Shasta, on the eastern side of the Cascade Range. It's the largest shield volcano in the Cascades, taking up an area of about 2,000 square kilometers. And this purple line outlines a ring of the eruptive centers that have been manifested over time. Also on here are just a few of the geological fault zones, which may or may not have some impact on the geothermal system. This is Medicine Lake. There, also on this map, we show all these white dots are temperature gradient holes. So they will go and they'll drill drill holes and they'll measure the temperature, because the temperature, of course, that's one of the main, that's part of the game in a geothermal field, temperature and then a permeable resource. So these are all temperature gradient wells, and in the wells denoted by the red dots, these are actual wells that they drilled looking for the geothermal resource. These three wells were productive on the order of, the Glass Mountain is not a huge geothermal resource, but these wells I think produce on the order of 3 to 5 megawatts per well. This well, 1786, I'm not sure why they drilled it here, but it encountered mechanical difficulty and so was abandoned. Although we do have some well log information from that well, which I'll come back to. And then finally, well 88A28, which is a recent well that was drilled in 2002, and based largely on the results of older NT, but with a heavy emphasis towards results from time domain. I'll show you in a minute, there's been a lot of time domain data collected in this area. Well 88A28 encountered nice high temperatures, but it wasn't a productive well. And we'll come back to that in a minute. Okay. Oh yes. I should say this is an ongoing volcanic activity. The last volcanic eruption is estimated to have been 900 years ago. None of the geophysics, there's a lot of geophysics that's been collected here, but none of it has detected any magma at depth, although it's thought that the heat source is granitic intrusion at depth. Okay, let's move on. So this slide just talks a little bit about the background and then the plan for our project. Glass Mountain has been explored by many companies throughout the years in the 1970s, 1980s, and now Calpine owns, actually let me just back up. Calpine owns two leases, one here, kind of hard to see outlines, the Telephone Flat area, where there's production and known resource, and then the four mile hill lease area, which is another promising geothermal resource, but which was unproductive with this well. So Calpine currently owns the leases within the rim, and I mentioned this about the well 88A28. So there's a large amount of legacy geophysical data, not only MT, but time domain, gravity, some seismic data, a large amount of geochemical data, a lot of temperature data, well cuttings, well borings, a lot of poor quality MT. So that was the data that they had, and so the plan was to go back. Calpine, as part of this project, agreed to publicly release a large amount of this data, which previously had been kept private. So we were going to, the first step was to take all this legacy data, go through it, and see what was useful, what wasn't, and compile it and put it into modern electronic format that we could actually use.
When you say data, do you mean partners would be at Facebook, or so do you mean tax savings?
The data expanded, there are data from in many different formats. Some of the old MT data from CGG just consisted of paper plots, and I wasn't that familiar with CGG, but I guess they had some strange way that they output data in some strange directions. So that's an example. That was all the data that was available from those, but that wasn't really useful because it was in inconsistent rotations and the digital data wasn't available. There were other data where the digital data were available, but they had to be taken off the old 9-track tapes and then converted to into EDI format, and so we could input into the analysis. And in fact, we used a lot of the old data in the analysis. But part of the plan was to acquire new MT soundings. So we acquired 91 new MT stations with co-located time domain to sort of fill in the gaps where previous gaps. And then we were going to apply state-of-the-art techniques and prepare an integrated 3D conceptual model of the reservoir. Okay, so this just gives you an idea of the amount of data that we looked at. MT, there are well over 300 data sets, but we ultimately culled those down to 170. Temperature gradient wells, this is very important, gives us temperature, the isotherms, we'll get to in a minute, are very important for analyzing geothermal systems. We had a lot of well cutting photography, a lot of cuttings that were sent to Joe Moore at Utah, and him and his group, they analyzed these for petrography, for alteration, which is very important. Deep induction log, we have a deep induction log that we could correlate directly with the resistivity coming out of the inversions. Time domain, gravity, other data sets which were looked at. Not everything was of usable quality, or some of the data sets were outside the area and weren't used. Okay, so, one thing I do want to say, if you notice in this power line, the high voltage DC power line, which runs from the northwest down to Southern California, and it turns out that actually, even though we're some distance away, that does have an effect on the data that we collected. But fortunately, so you have this huge coherent noise source out here, and it distorts your MT data.
On what? On the magnetic field or on the magnetic field?
Well, it's like you have a huge dipole source.
Yeah, along the field parallel to the wire.
And what you'll see as you get close, you'll see, and you see this a lot in Europe when you're close to the DC railways, you'll get apparent resistivities that go up at 45 degree angles, phases go to zero. You get large vertical magnetic transfer functions, which are not realistic.
The problem isn't the line, it's the reverse colors for the Earth.
How far is that?
Well, depending. You know, there's a power line that goes from Zimbabwe to Johannesburg, the Kabara Basa power line. And both of the grounding electrodes are in a resistive craton. And then the return colors flow through the Indian Ocean. Flow all the way around because that's the most inductive path. And so it's the path of the return colors of the problem.
Could this be also a part? Could this be for, say, in reverse? You can put it on a cable, but yeah.
Well,
why
so that's true, and so, luckily for us, we didn't have such an extreme remote. Luckily, at Glass Mountain, it affected data from about 10 seconds on down. And what we were looking for to characterize the geothermal reservoir, the action that we were really interested in, was 10 seconds and above. And so if you included the longer period data in the inversions, some strange things would start to happen. But if you excluded that, everything worked out nicely. So I just wanted to point that out.
If you didn't have those longer periods, can you filter up the power line among
it's tough. So most of the area is accessible except this area here, which is the rhyolite glass flows, and that's a picture of this area. So
we'll see.
Yeah, where would you put your electrodes here?
I did have 2 mega ohm resistance.
We actually tried to collect some data here because we had because we do work sometimes in high contact resistance areas, and we tried, and it just didn't work. And what's bad about this is some of the models indicate that there might be some possible geothermal resource under here, but it's hard without it's sort of a big gap in the data. But anyway, I just thought I'd show you some of the issues you're dealing with up here.
Have you ever thought, as a company, ever thought of using capacitive electrodes?
They've done some work with some sort of. We haven't used capacitive coupled, but with some electrodes with buffered high impedance.
Yeah, we have those, but we do need some capacitive.
But here is it's not too good. Okay, so. So I'm going to spend just a little bit of time talking about this is a picture of the standard geothermal model. It's been validated around the geothermal systems around the world. And this is really and this is really the important part of all this. So in the geothermal reservoir, you have heat and gas and magma, which rises up, and you have some upflow of hot saline fluids and fractures or whatever, and you get a lot of intense alteration of the minerals that are there. And so what you find is up at the top of the outflow, this alteration gives you smectite clay. And smectite clay, so the smectite clay forms a very impermeable boundary, first of all. But second of all, smectite clay is very conductive. And this is the conductive clay cap that you get at the top of geothermal reservoirs. As the temperature increases between about 100 and 200 degrees Celsius, smectite clay alters to illite clay, which is more resistive. And so, a couple things to take from this is that the distribution of the smectite clay closely follows the isotherms. It's very the presence and the resistivity of the smectite clay is very sensitive to the temperature. So the smectite clay is a good indicator of the geothermometry of the system. Back before when geophysicists first started to explore geothermal areas or electrical guys, it was often thought that they went around looking for big conductors where the reservoir, they expected to find big conductors. This reservoir would be full of hot saline fluids, it'd be a whopping conductor. And in fact, they would see this conductor, but the reservoir would be more resistive. And so in the early days, actually, a lot of people thought something was wrong with MT because it was failing miserably at these geothermal areas. Not just the early days, huh? So the resistivity of the rocks here is a factor of many things: temperature, fluids. But in these geothermal systems, it's the temperature and the clays that play the major role. So the smectite clay in the cap, very impermeable but very conductive, and transitions to illite, which is more resistive. And even though you have some saline fluids here, as you get deeper, the pressure closes up the porosity. So the overriding mechanism is controlled by the clays. So the idea is you map the... So geothermal exploration has largely been successful by mapping this clay cap, because the base of that clay cap is and it corresponds very closely to the top of the geothermal reservoir. Okay, so this is a map of all the time domain stations that have been collected in the Glass Mountain area. So you've gotten quite a good coverage. And before this well, 88A28, was drilled, there was another set of time domain data that was collected to help target, to help figure out where and what direction they wanted to target that well. And they chose time domain because it was a little cheaper. It was much cheaper than MT. Unfortunately, as I'll show, they should have chosen the MT, and they would have had done a better job of targeting the well.
What's the size of the loop?
The what?
Size of the loop of OTA.
Oh well, you know, it depends on. There's been different generations of time domain data. Yeah, so from smaller loop to larger loop. I can get you that information, I just don't know off the top of my head. So then this was sort of the conceptual model at the time that 88A28 was drilled and was largely used to target the direction that they drilled. So what we have plotted here, the purple is the rim of the caldera. And we have the depth to the 450 degree isotherm from all the temperature gradient wells. So the idea here is where it's hotter, closer to the surface, that's where you want to be, right? That's the geothermal resource. And then these yellow areas outline the areas of high conductance, which are related to the alteration. So you're looking for areas where you have highly altered rocks, and there's a heat source, because this is where the hot saline fluids come up. They're hot, and that's where you want to put your geothermal well. So this was the conductance from the time domain only, and this is from the surface down to 600 meters. And so this is what they were looking at. It looked like a really good target from the time domain. So, but unfortunately, the MT, this is sort of the conclusion slide, but I'll just show it now. The MT shows why that was not a good direction to drill. They should have drilled down in this direction. The intense alteration was down to the southwest, and they drilled down to the southeast. They encountered hot temperatures, but not the permeability. So this is the same type of slide, the conductance of the 3D MT model. Okay, so now let's get to the MT. This map shows the locations of all the MT stations in this area. This gap here is the rhyolite lava flows I showed earlier. And these are the MT sites from that we used in our study, the ones we collected and the old ones. Okay. We collected 91 new MT sites. And this just shows you the difference in the MT sites as a function of time. And so we have data back from the Woodward Clyde days of 1981. Pretty good data. CGG data. What? some data that was collected in 89, and then the recent data. And this was just, these are just sites, very close by. We do pretty good out to 10 to 100, 100
did
seconds.
Did you see any effect with the inner tile, the power line?
For this one, it's not so clear. There are other sites where it was clearer. And I'm not showing the vertical magnetic field, because sometimes it wasn't. Here we're far enough away that sometimes it's not so apparent in the apparent resistivity, but the vertical field was kind of kooky. Okay, so over the course of several years, I worked very closely with Bill Cumming, and some of the initial inversions I ran. Basically told me I was, you know, what, oh, so what, full of it, right? so what
full
do you do?
Full of
smectite clay. I mean, I have no. So over the course of several years, we've done lots of inversions and improved, and always working really closely to match the result of the MT modeling with all the data that we have. And we, you know, it's not just, it's got to match the temperature data and the well data and the alteration data and photography. So these are just some of the conclusions we came to during the course of this investigation. You really, you know, early on I thought you don't need very many frequencies. You know, we can get away with only using a few broadly spaced frequencies because it's smoothly varying. But in reality, you do a much better job, especially in those areas where you really want to constrain that clay cap, by having more frequencies. So that was one thing. Using larger model grids, finding smaller blocks, so more model, grid points, allow you to better model the topography and all the variations within that. Interactive editing is an important thing. You don't just dump all your data into your inversion code and without looking at the data. First of all, you got to go through station by station and look at the data and edit out obviously bad data. Because even though, you know, some people will say, well, just let the inversion code deal with it. But the problem is, if the data is there, the inversion code is still going to try to fit it. So you've got to take out the bad data first. It's always a trade-off between smoothing and fitting structure. So
there's a wonderful tool in Winglink to allow you.
Montague is included, but then early on we couldn't, because my computational resources in the beginning were not as good as they are now, we had to have larger blocks, which didn't do a very good job. We found we do a much better job with smaller blocks. And still staircase, but, you know.
How is it that you can do a much better, faster computation now?
Because I have a bigger cluster that I've made a lot of changes. I've made a lot of advances within the code to make it as fast as possible to solve each Ford problem as quickly as possible. And then...
Is it just one multiprocessor piece?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, what all this is trying to say, no, we're running this on a 72 processor, but all I was trying to say, and I mentioned this the other day, is right now I have a quad core, I have a parallel machine on my desk, right? It's a quad core. I could put in four of those and I could have 16 and I could put up to, what, 32 gigabytes or something? So right there is a pretty good little parallel machine that you can have on your desktop. You know, it's not going to be long before you can have the ability, we'll have the ability to run 3D inversions on your desktop. So that's the point I was trying to make. Okay, so this is back to the NT conductives. It shows the geothermal resources in this area and up here. One of the other things I learned in all this is maps like this are really good because in 3D inversions, and we saw this in the when we were trying to invert the secret data, often because the data was inconsistent, a structure was being put different places, right? A lot of us saw that. So what these maps are good for is if you look at the conductance of your 3D model, you start to see a lot of stuff in between stations. You've got to start to wonder, like, you got to start to be suspicious of that, okay? So if the inversion, sometimes the inversion will like to put stuff here because it thinks it can fit the data better over here, but because there's not a station to constrain it, it allows to do that. But it's likely, you have to be suspicious and wonder if that's just an artifact, okay? Like, for example, this here, which is under the rhyolite glass fold. We have to be suspicious. Is that conductance real or is that an artifact of the inversion? Well, if you didn't have any more information, I think you'd have to be very skeptical of that. But because we have other information here, the time domain, we know that that's actually probably pretty reasonable. That conductance is probably real. So again, just another thing, you really got to be critical of your own inversion models. And it's kind of hard to take, you know, when... I speak from experience. When you spend all this time and effort to develop a code and you run these and you think you've done a great job and your colleague comes back and tells you it's a, you know, bunch of crap, you know, it's kind of hard to deal with. So well, you see the abuse I get here. He invites me to come and then I'm abused. Yeah, I'd hate it if he didn't like me. Can't imagine. So I'm going to show just a profile first from right here, which goes through these wells, and then a longer profile that goes through here.
But then what is conductance? So you
integrated conductance from the surface down. And why that's useful, and especially it works well with like 1D time domain models, is each individual time domain model may be off a little bit. Or the 1D MT model might be off a little bit. But if you integrate it down, it actually turns out to be quite useful and then sort of averages some of that out. And that approach actually has been validated in lots of geothermal areas. It's one of the few cases where 1D actually does a quite reasonable job. So this is just a cross section of the electrical resistivity from that on the shorter profile. This is well 17A6, which drilled down to here, but then had mechanical problems and was abandoned. And then this well here, some entries into the well. And so we have temperature information, the alteration patterns, the top of the argillic alteration zone, and then the top, the bottom here is propylitic copper from the well cuttings, conductive clay cap, which is due to the smectite clays in this layer, followed very closely the isotherms, which we expect it to do. And then more resistive at depth due to the closing of pores and the presence of illite clay. The top of the reservoir is at a higher resistivity here because it's deeper, and again, that also correlates well with rock physics. Here it is. Here's the well log from that well, and in black is the resistivity from the well log, and red is the resistivity from the result of the 3D inversion, and then the blues are some results from 1D inversions, and you see the 3D inversion follows quite well the is most the trend of the well log gets the high conductivity of the smectite zone. Here you see the alteration type. This is from the well cutting analysis and the geology. You have a steep gradient in temperature, and that's due to this impermeable zone where you don't get any water flow through. So then this validates the interpretation of the resistivity in terms of the smectite illite model at Glass Mountain. Okay. What am I going to look at next? Okay. So this is, we'll just look at another cross section, which is the longer cross section. Some of the interpretation here is interpretation in terms of a geothermal system, where is upflow, where is outflow. That's important for the people who want to target wells. So I won't go through that, but
so if you're on that side, Randy, if you were able to just use, let's say, from 5 hertz to 500 hertz, okay, which is the that's the frequency band of some of these airborne systems now that are trying to. Basically, it's a reconstruction of the old AFMAG system, so they'll measure vertical component of fields and have vertical component transfer function. You get down to maybe 5 hertz or 10 hertz. So you wouldn't be able to see through that.
You could probably see the top of the you see the top of the clay.
And you might be able to get some idea about that. The loss of clay there. Would that be a useful thing?
I think it's useful. The what they're really after is the base of the clay, because that's the top of the geothermal reservoir. And that also closely corresponds, you can see it follows very closely to the temperature isotherms. Is my time up? Okay, I'm almost done.
Okay.
Good. Almost done. Sorry. Got carried away here. So, anyway, I'll wrap it up. I mean, there's more. This was just the other well I wanted to show, but again, it correlates quite well with. Let me just jump to the end here. Sorry. Just got so excited about it. Then this is sort of a summary of the conceptual model of the reservoir. We have upflow regions here and outflow, and of course this is where you have high temperatures, and this is where there's a good geothermal resource. And we think that this well probably should have been drilled a little further down to the south. There's upflow here, and so it's in this zone where you really want to locate your well. So this is based, we have to mention that this work was funded by the California Energy Commission. And while funded by the California Energy Commission, they're not responsible for any of the conclusions that we made. There's only the conclusions of the authors of the study, and don't represent the official views of the California Energy Commission. So. So, any quick questions, or I guess we want to move on?
Can you explain again, what was the problem with the TDM data?
problem is the map of the conductance down to 600 meters was probably, based only on time domain, were probably overestimated the conductance in that one area. But and that's what they based the targeting of the well on. And it turned out from the MT, the map of the MT conductance, which was a better estimate because we have better depth, we can see beyond 600 meters, showed that that conductance was being overestimated by the time domain.
Good question. First, what did you do for static shift in the analysis?
Yeah, that's a good question. Do you want me to answer that first?
Yes.
Okay, so we did actually look at that, and we tried inversions with and without static shift. And when you invert for static shift, it tries to estimate the static shifts that will give you, you know, that will reduce the objective function to a smoother model. And it worked fine, but we didn't fit the resistivity didn't fit the data at the well. It was shifted by about 200 meters. The inversions without the static shift fit the well data. And so what the inversion was doing was taking out real structure. So that's why I keep saying I've not been convinced that when you go to 3D that we need to really be, I haven't seen a case from the data we've collected that a convincing case for taking out static shifts.
The other comment is that what the reservoir geothermal people are really interested in fractures. That's the holy grail, and we say, well, we can find new resistivity. So this sort of model is a second-hand indicator of possible porosity down there. But the question is, do you see any way that we can improve our methods so that we eventually go after fracture systems? That's what they really want.
The problem, the way I understand that, is the problem is that at depth, even though there's fractures there, you'd need the amount of porosity and permeability that you need to really get something that really stands out in MT is probably greater than what they expect. Yeah, I think that's the problem. I'm sure it exists, but I'm not an expert in that. But from what I understand, that's the problem.
No.
Well, I didn't say that. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people, some people are interested in whether we can improve our imaging of what's going on in the reservoir. And I don't think that's a done deal yet. I don't think it's out of the question, but we've got to collect better data. And I think it takes very accurate data.
Okay. Were there any seismic information available? Like you mentioned microseismicity. What about detection?
Probably not reflection. There was probably micro-earthquake studies, and I can't tell you off the top of my head.
What did the micro-earthquake data show?
I can't tell you that either. I didn't look at it personally, so I think it was looked at and thought to not really have that much information for what we were. It was more